From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
If it has occurred to you that playing basketball for a living might be a pretty sweet deal, you have company in a 6-foot-10-inch gentleman whose first book has just been published. Since he graduated from college 5 years ago, Paul Shirley has been playing basketball for anybody who'd hire him. Sometimes that has meant sitting on the bench for a team that made it all the way to the NBA's Western Conference Finals. Sometimes it has meant risking his life as he tried to navigate the chaotic traffic circle that stood between his hotel room and the gym where the team for which he played in Russia practiced. Unlike a lot of people who play games for a living, Paul Shirley appears to have a viable alternative. He didn't leave college early, in part because no pro team was particularly interested in drafting him. He stuck around Iowa State and earned an engineering degree. So when we spoke this week, I began the conversation by asking Shirley what had made him decide to continue playing basketball as a pro.
I don't think it was too tough a decision because someone offered to pay me money to play a game. And as condescending as that may sound, it is true. And at the base level, it's kind of amazing that people are willing to give me money to try to put a ball in a hoop.
This remains surprising to you even 4 years into your much-traveled career.
Yeah, I think it's surprising to anyone because it seems so dumb, doesn't it? I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that has been reflected in the stuff I've written, just that I remain confused that people are willing to pay to watch me play basketball.
At what point in this basketball career did it become apparent that if you were going to remain employed, you were going to have to look for work in such places as Greece and Spain and Russia?
I think actually before my career even started, I hooked up with an agent who is similar to my parents probably in that he's a little bit too much of a realist. And he told me early on that it would never be an easy road, that I would not be expecting NBA riches all the time, that we'd have to bounce back and forth between Europe and the NBA. For me, it's been good because I've been able to, in some ways, finance the NBA dream by going and being a mercenary in other countries.
Mm-hmm. The agent of whom you speak is Keith Glass. We spoke to Keith a while back when his book came out, and he specializes in finding employment for very tall white men. So you had the right agent, right?
Yes. He originally was thinking of calling his book 81 Feet of White Centers, I believe.
You sat on the bench for the Phoenix Suns for about half a season, a good run in the life of a man accustomed to 10-day contracts. Did you feel more a part of the team in Phoenix than you had felt a part of any of the teams in the other places you'd played?
I did, and that is somewhat strange because I didn't play very much there. There were other places where I actually played a fair amount, the Chicago Bulls being an example of that. But, and I think this is reflected in the success that the Phoenix Suns have had, they actually embrace everyone on the team and not just the stars.
Mm-hmm. Were the Los Angeles Lakers the first team to tell you that you could not, in fact, keep your jersey after you were cut? This is, of course, the title of your book.
This is indeed. They are, and they remain, in fact, the only team that has done that. I think perhaps I just got a little more demonstrative with my demands after that.
Well, what the hell do you suppose they did with the Lakers jersey that said Shirley across the back?
You know, I've always said there's nothing you could do with a Lakers jersey with Shirley on the back. However, if you think about it, it could actually become more worthwhile than the 50 million O'Neal jerseys or Bryant jerseys because there's only one Shirley jersey in existence.
You have been critical of the brand of basketball that most NBA teams currently play. Too much emphasis on defense, you write, not enough good shooters, too much control by the coaches telling everybody what to do and when to do it. As a member of several teams in the NBA, have you had any impact on changing things?
I think I've had negative impact. I think people are actually doing the opposite of what I wish. you mentioned the coaching aspect. I think it's interesting when people look back at the history of basketball that when it was first played intercollegiately or basically in any competitive way, the coaches weren't even on the bench. Coaches were in the stands. And I've had really good coaches at points in my career, Tim Floyd in college and Mike D'Antoni in Phoenix, who understood that they had to prepare the players for the game before the game, but once the game started, it was up to the players to do that. I've compared basketball to jazz in the past, and I think that in a lot of ways is true. Basketball is very different from football, which is very scripted and pre-planned. Basketball is all about reaction, and I think that's kind of the beautiful thing about the game.
It is interesting, though, that basketball is a sport in which, particularly at the college level, the coach has become the star. I mean, the camera in a telecast of a college game is as often on Bobby Knight or whoever the coach may be as it is on the players.
Right. I don't understand that fully. I think it's probably due to the fact that in college especially, the players are shipped on to the NBA and their next round of illegitimate children or whatever. So there is some continuity in making the coach the cult of personality instead of the player.
One of the more surprising statements in Can I Keep My Jersey is the following. I'm quoting now. I am constantly amazed by the ability of others to care about sporting events. Have you heard from Commissioner Stern regarding that pronouncement?
Not yet. I think he has other things on his mind as of yet.
But tell me a little bit about what you meant, because one would think in the kind of small and self-contained world of pro basketball that it would be self-evident to the players that what they're doing is extremely important and worth caring about.
I think this is, people have accused me of being a little high and mighty at times, and that's probably true. But I don't understand how adults can get so wrapped up in a game that they're willing to take off their shirt and paint their chest purple and orange for a playoff game, or write in signs that this game is more important than going to work that night. Or
yeah, there is one sign that you quote that's actually quite extraordinary. Remind me of how that works.
I think
exactly.
they were talking about they were trying to use that old Visa or MasterCard slogan of missing a playoff game or missing my work to attend a Suns playoff game, priceless or something. You remember that campaign? And my contention was, is that really priceless? I mean, you're watching a playoff game of 10 men who you have never met, who don't care anything about you, and you paid to do this. Is that really that exciting? Is that up there with, like, having a child or, your parents' 50th wedding anniversary? I don't think so. I guess my problem is I grew up a huge basketball fan. When I was 8 years old or 10 years old, the Kansas Jayhawks lost in the Final Four, and I cried like a baby. But I don't necessarily understand how a 45-year-old man can do that.
One of the other acknowledgments that sort of surprised me, but delighted me in your book, was your admission that sometimes on the sideline when the coach was instructing players, you couldn't help yourself, you were watching the dance team.
It's true. NBA games are long, and NBA seasons are even longer. So there's a fair amount of scoping the stands for extracurricular activities. Sadly, those extracurricular activities are not nearly as debaucherous as people would seem or would think. A lot of times people ask me about the groupie scene, as it were. But unfortunately in the NBA now, because everything is so sterile and businesslike, we often, or most of the time in fact, fly to the next city directly after the game. So there is little time for sending a manager into the crowd with a phone number.
Little time, but I'm sure no lack of real desire to do that.
Right, right. In a lot of ways, we're like 13-year-olds over there talking a great game but never engaging in it.
Well, that's another point since you've brought it up. You characterize yourself as an intelligent fellow, and you certainly seem to be so. You're a National Merit Scholarship finalist. But you suggest that that is, in fact, one of the reasons you don't have close friends in pro basketball.
Well, I have multiple theories on that subject, but one of them, and I think I talked about this in the book a little bit, is that it's not a great characteristic to be really smart in order to play sports, because concentrating for small amounts of time on something as seemingly meaningless as putting a ball in a basket is a different mental exercise than learning calculus. It's two separate parts of the brain in a lot of ways. And I feel like a lot of people who are gifted at, say, taking the ACT aren't necessarily going to be good at dumbing themselves down enough to not worry about the fact that they missed seven shots in a row and that they need to keep shooting. And I fall somewhere in between. I'm constantly overanalyzing, but I'm also obviously good enough at basketball that I've overcome some of that. And there aren't a lot of guys like me. That's not to say that I'm necessarily smarter than they are. It's just that I haven't, in some ways, figured out exactly how to balance those two as well as other people have.
Maybe that's why you keep playing. I mean, it's the search for that balance.
I think you're exactly right. There is that hope that I can start to figure out how to put one part of my personality, intellect, whatever, aside and succeed at that high level.
Of course, another way to put that is I keep playing basketball because I aspire to being really dumb.
Right, right. I always contend that at some point I'm going to start trying to play drunk and just see how it goes because I feel like I might actually have more success.
Assuming your experience with several NBA teams was the top of the line so far, what is the most unpleasant place you've ever been employed as a basketball player?
I think the popular choice would probably be Yakima, Washington. However, Kazan, Russia was much, much worse. I had actually always wanted to play in Russia, so I was shocked when I hated it there. I had this vision of a, you know, the whole glasnost kind of thing, that this was going to be a very open and interesting place. But it's still very much a third world country, and I kind of felt like I was going to disappear at any moment.
Why did you initially think Russia would be a good choice of places to play?
I suppose I bought into the propaganda like everyone else that it was a much more westernized place than it actually is. And that's not to say that Russia is inherently a bad place. However, Kazan, Russia is a pretty bad place. I think I wrote about this too. On my way out of the country, I had to stop at the consulate in New York to get my visa to get into Russia. And as I was standing in line, I told a Russian man who was also in line that I was going to Kazan, and his only reaction was to shake his head and kind of cast his eyes downward, which is not exactly the motivation I needed to get on that Aeroflot plane.
Yeah, you describe the weather was not exactly perfect there. Minus 10 was a pretty good day in terms of temperature. And the traffic was a major problem just getting from your apartment to the arena.
Right. They haven't really figured out things like infrastructure in Russia or especially in Kazan. They don't seem to understand that if you put more cars on the road, you actually need bigger roads. That logic has eluded them to this point.
Spoken like an engineer.
Yes, I sink into my wheelhouse occasionally.
Your most recent basketball experience has occurred too recently to have made it into Can I Keep My Jersey? How was basketball in Menorca in 07?
Fantastic, actually. I was speaking with an old college coach of mine recently, Tim Floyd, the aforementioned Tim Floyd, and trying to express just how pleasant that experience was. I am quite cynical and have become a little jaded towards professional basketball, so it comes as a surprise to people when I rave about something like that. They assume that I'm kidding, but my time in Spain was great because I really rediscovered why I play the game, that feeling of contributing to a meaningful win as the crowd is roaring and all that is kind of transcendental, as it turns out.
I'm glad that the most recent experience was positive because, you know, for some people, traveling the way you have traveled might be great fun, but you don't seem to have enjoyed a lot of the travel. By my reckoning, you accuse Greeks, Turks, Indians, Czechs, and Russians of smelling bad, and everywhere you go outside the U.S., you complain about the traffic, the food, and the medical care. Why haven't you just taken a job in the U.S. as an engineer?
Great question. I suppose it does come off that I've been unappreciative of all this, but I think that I think hopefully people will understand that a lot of this is tongue-in-cheek and that I'm serious about complaining about it at the time, but over the long haul, I certainly appreciate the fact that I've gotten to do some amazing things. I've been to Istanbul, Turkey, when most people I know will never get to go there. I've been to Kazan, Russia, and even though I didn't like it, I know what it's like, which is a step in the right direction. I recently said somewhere or wrote that I don't know that I would trade the career I've had, which has been filled with lots of misery, to truth be told, for a 6-year deal worth $2 million a year, just because I've gotten to experience so many things, and now I can look back fondly upon those things. When I'm writing about them, and when it happened at the time, I wasn't too pleased about the fact that my spleen and kidney were ruptured by Austin Crozier, but looking back on it, it makes for a hell of a good story to tell the girls in the bar.
I want to go back to another moment that I found kind of intriguing, especially intriguing in this book, because it seems to me to indicate how even a player under contract to an NBA team can be somewhat tongue-tied and kind of baffled in the presence of a superstar. You walk into the Lakers locker room and you introduce yourself to Shaquille O'Neal, and he says, "I know you. I know who you are."
Yeah. Thanks for stealing the punchline. No,
it's what I do best.
Yeah. I guess for me, coming out of college, and I think that's what, to back up, people react well to what I've written because I am the sort of standard, like, white guy from the Midwest, and they can understand how I view the NBA because that's pretty much how they view the NBA. I think most people, most of my friends here in Kansas City or people I've met wherever in the world would have a similar reaction in that they would be scared out of their minds to approach Shaquille O'Neal or Kobe Bryant just because they know so much about that person, because they are so self-aware, which is a curse of us sometimes, of us being the middle-class Midwesterners, I suppose. And so for me, it took an amazing amount of gumption just to get up the guts to go say to Shaquille O'Neal, who was now my coworker, who was then my coworker, that my name was Paul Shirley, and ask him what his name was, like he's a normal human being, not one of the five most recognizable humans on the planet.
Paul Shirley, who may soon be playing basketball in a city near you, no matter where you live, is the author of Can I Keep My Jersey? 11 Teams, 5 Countries, and 4 Years in My Life as a Basketball Vagabond, published by Villard. He joined me from the studios of KCUR in Kansas City. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No, thank you.
My conversation with Paul Shirley will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be exploring the phenomenon that is apparently ageless fastballer Roger Clemens, who has left in his wake several cities full of fans who hope that when he starts pitching for the Yankees again, he'll get hammered. I'll be talking about the arm injuries that pitchers other than the indestructible Clemens have had to battle with Buzz Bissinger, who's been researching same. We'll have a story about flying airplanes between pylons at 200 miles an hour for the entertainment of people on the ground in Monument Valley, Utah, and all around the world. And we'll be updating the NBA playoffs as well. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.